Welcome to the CSIS podcast, a look at the week's news and foreign policy through the eyes of the experts at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm Colin Quinn. Now, what do Turkey, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Jordan, France, Canada, Bahrain, Australia, the United States, and now Russia have in common? Well, they've all been involved in airstrikes in Syria. Russia's the newcomer after joining in the fighting this week, although not in the way coalition forces would like, with Russian jets coming to the aid of Bashar al-Assad in striking threats to his rule, hitting rebel positions as well as those held by terrorist groups. In a crisis that only makes turns for the worse, it's an unwelcome development, adding an extra layer of unpredictability to how the conflict in Syria will play out. So why is Russia playing this game now? Is there strategy behind the bravado? On this week's show, Anthony Cordesman talks us through.
Well, I think that it may be a different set of choices. First, the base Russia actually had at Tartus, and it is not at Latakia, was essentially a couple of piers, and they weren't really even long enough piers and ready enough to take Russia's larger ships. It wasn't really a base in the sense that we think of as a military base. That is being improved. That's somewhat being ignored with the focus on the air power. It wasn't strategically critical. People talk about it as if it was vital to Russia keeping a fleet in the Mediterranean, but the fact is there were other ways that Russia could have handled both the servicing on its ships and replenishment, because it isn't going to war in any case. What they have done now is establish real air bases. Now, these are the first real military bases Russia has had in Syria. They did have, in the past, larger facilities. But this is the first time this has been really oriented toward serious combat. And it is not a vast base. We're talking about essentially a mixture of some 40 aircraft, fixed wing, and somewhere around 14 to 20 helicopters. But it is a very significant one because it's flying combat missions, and it evidently is going to keep flying them. Now, when we come down to motives, there are a couple of issues to remember. One is Russia is seeking to reestablish its status and visibility by being in Syria, by backing Assad, in a world where many developing countries have authoritarian leaders and where that leader's survival is critical to the leader, if not necessarily the country, Russia's taken a very powerful step. Many people will see this as you can deal with Russia where if it's the United States and Europe, they're going to be concerned about democracy, human rights. They're going to be very careful about the support if there's any kind of public opposition to the government. And this is what Russia has already exploited more than a year ago in what they call the Color Revolutions, which is the theory that the U.S. and Europe have been destabilizing the developing world and in the process either creating extremism and terrorism or attempting to take control of these countries. So this is a logical extension of a strategy Russia has begun to pursue, and that's partly in reaction to the Ukraine. And here again, it's important to realize that one way to distract people from the Ukraine, one way to focus the world's attention on other issues, is to have these operations inside Syria. Another difference is the way in which you deal with counter-extremism or counter-terrorism. Russia does not see this in terms of reforming states. It sees it in terms of preserving secular regimes that can bring order and structure. People tend to focus on Putin, but the Russian foreign minister, other Russian senior commanders, officials have talked about the West, and particularly the United States, as destabilizing Libya, destabilizing Iraq, potentially destabilizing Syria, as helping to generate ISIS. They've talked about U.S. failures in Afghanistan and the U.S. as creating problems with the stability of Central Asia. And this, again, has some validity. We've not been particularly successful as yet in what have been very long wars and very expensive ones. I mean, we're talking something on the order of $2 trillion. But on the other hand, it's not clear that simply backing authoritarians works either. Now, how much of this also is Putin's feeling that Russia has been encircled, that NATO expanded in spite of what he claims are pledges that it wouldn't, that the outside rim around Russia has been deliberately used to contain and limit Russia's influence? These are the views of quite a number of Russians other than Putin. It's one of the reasons he's had considerable popular support. So when you try to figure out of this mix of motives, how much of this is Putin, how much of it is the Russian security apparatus, how much of it is Russian nationalism and Russia's history. And it is a history which has been, if Russia wasn't expanding, it was under siege. It's a fairly grim one over quite a long period. These are areas where I think none of us really can weigh that. And I would have to say that as someone who is constantly involved in the mind-reading exercises of the leaders of the Kremlin back in the days of the former Soviet Union, most of that mind-reading simply reflected the prejudices of the mind-reader. Very little of it turned out to be right.
This is a PR campaign almost by Russia to win over people to its way of thinking. I mean, it's a pretty expensive play. And I mean, what does Russia gain from winning Syria in the state that it's in?
Well, you made a number of assumptions. One thing is Russia doesn't have to win. It just has to try. The second is that deploying these combat aircraft is not cheap. It also isn't particularly expensive. This is a relatively limited number of forces and assets. A lot of it is equipment Russia already has, its forces it already has, probably the facilities, the food, the supplies, the fuel are all free because they're coming from Syria. The marginal cost of this is certainly something that the average businessman wouldn't do, but in terms of international prestige and power, it's cheap. It does distract the world from the Ukraine. That is a strategic goal. It establishes Russia's presence. It has asserted Russia relative to the United States. That is a strategic goal. And one thing that we are not particularly good at in the U.S. is remembering that what we sometimes call PR is for us usually spinning whatever we're talking about in terms of existing policies into success. What it should be is strategic communications, and this is taking actions which actually achieve strategic goals by shaping world and public opinion. And in that sense, I think Russia's had considerably more success in the last 2 weeks in shaping world opinion than the U.S. has had more recent, at least 2 to 3 years, in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, I can see that you win that point. When strikes started happening in Syria, the word was, you know, the U.S. is not working with Assad on this, is not talking to Assad. You know, U.S. is taking out its targets how it likes. Now, with Russia involved, there has to be some way that we have to work with Russia in order to, like, avoid certain outcomes that we don't want. How does that actually take place, or is that taking place?
Well, it has begun to take place, and you've had public announcements about it from fairly senior Department of Defense spokesmen today. But it was clear that it began much earlier and that Russia provided limited but some advance notice of its actions. How much is really required here is something you have to be a little careful about, because so far, while Russia has talked about attacks on ISIS, all of its actual sorties have been flown really in protection of Assad's forces and close to the area that Assad occupies, not against ISIS at all. The other thing is that with radar, you have reasonable coverage of when somebody else is flying sorties. And remember that time over target, the time when you might have a conflict, an incident, is actually relatively brief with jet fighters. You're not talking about filling the sky with a constant presence. So a lot of this can be worked out, and particularly because the U.S. has not been flying any sorties against Assad's forces. The sorties have been flown essentially against either ISIS or really hardline Islamist movements like the al-Nusra Front, which is the al-Qaeda subsidiary in Syria. So there are always risks in this game. There are always risks if Russia expands its strikes and attacks. But one thing you also have to remember, that short of a collision, there's no reason for any kind of air-to-air combat. It's not like you were suddenly going to have a U.S. aircraft blunder into a fighter-on-fighter exchange between Russia and some rebel air force, because there isn't any.
The involvement by Russia, does that create any sort of leverage on Assad that in some perverse way could bring the end to the conflict, could actually bring peace by having a bigger player like Russia able to exert control over Assad?
Well, let's remember what the realities are here. First, it isn't just Russia, it's Iran. It is not a unified Assad movement. If Assad steps down, what nobody has asked, fine, he's gone, now what? Because the Alawites are a relatively small minority. The bulk of Assad's forces were originally Sunnis. Much of his coalition is Sunni. There are other minorities, fairly significant ones, in Syria. So there's no easy successor to Assad. We're talking about the Kurds, which in Syria were almost non-citizens before this began. Now they have their own enclave and their own forces. You're talking about ISIS, and ISIS isn't ready to negotiate. Just because Assad steps down, the last thing on earth we are going to do is reach an accommodation with ISIS. And then you talk about the other rebels, and the other rebels are a mixture of Islamists, some tiny elements we supported and trained, some more moderate elements in the rebel forces which have the support of the Gulf Arab states. So that's four different movements, and we talk about this as if two outside powers could sort of preside over the civil war by somehow getting rid of Assad. And then we come down to the rather grim realities there. There are different estimates of the population, somewhere between 18 and 23 million. Since early this spring, we have talked about 4 million registered refugees. The number is probably up to 4.5 now, and a lot of them are no longer registered. They're headed toward Europe. You have something on the order of another 7 million what we call independently displaced persons. These are still in Syria, but the definition of an IDP is somebody who has moved far enough so they no longer have their business, their job, or their home. That is not something you put back quickly together. And if you look on the internet, you will see photos of the amount of damage done to key Syrian cities in this fighting. And there are whole areas, large parts of those cities, which have been flattened or lost the buildings. This is a Syrian economy which can be anywhere from, and estimates really differ, a fifth to about 40% of what it was in 2011. So talking about this as if all it took was a bunch of people negotiating from the outside at the top, and there was no sequel, there was no problems, and somehow all of these fighters would mysteriously fall into line, there are certain elements of the theater of the absurd in some of the approaches to negotiation.
You know, considering the U.S. has a plan for Syria and has a plan for how to bring it out of its current mire.
Now let's be very careful. During the 2 weeks before the Russians deployed, the White House made it clear that it was doing a zero-based reassessment of its strategy for Syria. So if we had a plan, we didn't have it even before the Russians began to fly their sorties.
Okay, well, knowing that the plan is in progress, how much does Russia's involvement change what the U.S. can do?
I think it certainly reduces the leverage that in the short term had pushed Assad to the point where he was clearly losing. It's not clear what Russia's sorties will do over time yet. But it does change the balance on the ground. It gives Assad more options and more time. And that makes it harder to negotiate. But again, the question was always, negotiate what? And the problem is simply going into the negotiations and getting rid of Assad is kind of the first 3% of shaping a meaningful future.
And that was Anthony Cordesman bringing us to the end of this week's show. We'll be back with more next week. So until then, I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.